Kick-Ass Vets, sharing tips to help empower you to take control of your career. Hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us with Kick-Ass Vets. Today, we are very excited to have Dr. Sarah here with us, who is from the UK and has immense amounts of experience and has recently started her own website called Sarah the Vet. It's at sarathevet.com. You can check it out. We'll show you it in a minute. I'd like to let people have their own introduction so that I'm not missing anything or screwing anything up. So welcome, Dr. Sarah. Thank you so much for joining us. And if you want to tell us kind of a bit about your background and history to get us going, that would be great.
Thank you for the introduction, Anne. So as Anne says, I work in the UK. I've always worked in the UK. I graduated 18 years ago from the University of Glasgow. And at that kind of time, it was kind of typical to go into a mixed practice job. And that's what I did. So for 6 years, I did kind of the James Herriot ideal. And I did actually really love it. It was a lot of interaction with farmers, out and about, feeling like part of the community. But it came time that I thought, well, that's kind of the limits of what I can do with that. So I went off looking for other jobs. I actually met my husband, and we went travelling for 6 months at that point. Yes. And then I found my next job, which I stayed for 10 years in that next job.
Oh, wow.
That was a small animal only position because my husband's profession is much more precise than mine. He's not a vet. So he had to find the job first, and then I followed him. And unfortunately, it was to a part of the country there really are no cows at all. It's just outside London. So I changed to small animal. I've got mixed feelings about that. I really definitely miss getting outside and out and about and the interaction with farmers. But the farm animal work was definitely very much fire brigade work. So they'd only call you out if they had something they couldn't deal with themselves, so like having to do a calving or cesarean, and it was also very, very manual and hard work. And although I was young and fit at that time, I just thought, I can't see myself doing that for 40 years. So the move to small animal work was really interesting. It was at that stage a very small independent practice, just one base and a tiny little branch, and we worked very much as a team and colleagues. But over those 10 years, the practice did grow a lot, and the bosses and management went on lots of management training, and things started to change, which I was not entirely happy with, that the way that life was going there. So a couple of years ago, I decided that was kind of like where I got to with the end of that job as well. And it was also, I actually went through a period of burnout at that stage as well. The hours were just got out totally out of control.
Waiting for 16 years to hit the burnout mark is pretty impressive. Most of us are hitting it a lot sooner than that.
Yeah, I know. But yeah, so that was part of the reason of leaving there. So it was burnout. The job was changing. They made it clear that I couldn't be part of being involved in shaping what the changes were.
Oh, okay.
Like they were internal promotions, and they had worded them such that you didn't feel like you wanted to apply. And then when they promoted someone, they changed the title and what that person was doing to be what I would have applied for. So yeah, it made it clear that it wasn't going to stick out in that job anyway. So I went traveling again. Yay, travel.
always the best thing to do.
It definitely is. And I came back to another job in the UK, another part of the UK actually, much more rural, more kind of fitting for what we want out of life. But unfortunately, that job was missold to me as well. So after a year, I ended up leaving there as well. And then, so this takes us to about this time last year. So I was in a position where this job isn't working out. There is a recruitment crisis in the UK, like there is in Australia. Yeah. And whenever I looked at jobs, there were just hundreds and hundreds of jobs. And they all said exactly the same stuff. Come work for us. We're a lovely team. Cake on Fridays. And we have digital x-rays. Nobody chooses a job on those things. And so I actually tried something called reverse recruitment. So I advertised myself out on mostly social media, a little bit on LinkedIn and things. And the response I got that from that was totally overwhelming, which is not surprising in a recruitment crisis. I'm a vet with experience and special skills. And I thought that might help me find the right role, because I thought I'd been quite precise in what I was asking for from the practices.
And you thought they would filter and would care what you wanted? That's an interesting...
Yes, I was naive. Yes, I've learned my lesson on that. And unfortunately, yes, I found another job. And yeah, within a few weeks this time, I went, oh dear, this is not what I thought this was going to be. So since then, I've started locuming. And so I've now been a locum for 6 months.
Nice. Welcome to the club.
And that definitely has its pros and cons as well. Certainly, I like having the freedom to decide where I work. So I have been to visit some practices that want to use my services, and I've gone, oh, I'm really sorry, I have no availability, basically to protect myself from the standards of that practice. They would really impinge on my values. So I like the flexibility of that, but also there's a whole lot of uncertainty. And obviously in this current circumstance, this past week, everything has gone haywire, and there is no certainty, and all my contracts from here on in have been cancelled. So I have got no idea what my future looks like.
Yeah, you definitely...
At least I get to choose it.
Yeah, you definitely have to, like, you have to have that safety net as a locum, whether that's a partner that makes income or whether that's, you know, a climate that just has abundant work, which is the situation except when you're in lockdown. Because yeah, I don't know whether or not vets are listed as essential services in the UK. I know my friends back in Canada, it's not. So if they do total lockdown, which they're close to, then all of their clinics are going to have to close, and like people can't afford to pay their vets if they're not bringing in money. So it's pretty scary. Do you know if vets are essential services in the UK? Like if there's complete lockdown, if they'll stay open?
I don't actually know that, and I expect nobody actually knows that until the time comes to actually decide it, unfortunately. A lot of practices are at this moment voluntarily scaling back their services and finding other ways to make sure that people aren't coming into clinics, so doing lots of telemedicine, which up until a few months ago, everyone was like, oh, we don't want that, and then all of a sudden it's like, yes, let's have telemedicine.
I don't know why... Yeah, I don't know why people don't just, like, sit in their car, do the consult over the phone, and go take the pet inside, do the exam, because that's what you need them for. You need to do the exam. So much of telemedicine, the problem is that people, what they describe to you is completely different of what you see. But, yeah, there's a big hesitation, because at home that's what they're trying to do is just have – so in Canada, sorry, at home, they're trying to – scale back at emergencies only, nothing routine, nothing that doesn't urgently need to be done, and then try to get people to wait in their cars. You go get the pet, bring it in, do the exam, everything over the phone, which I think is a great solution for vet clinics. And I think everyone should just jump on board, but there seems to be a lot of hesitation here to go to that step, and I don't know why.
I think so. Yeah. Well, I don't know if you've noticed, but I think that the veterinary profession is quite traditional and backward-looking in very many ways.
Yes.
And this is just one more example of it.
Yes.
I think the profession is really resistant to any kind of change, and that is part of what's not doing it a very good service at the moment, is that we need to be proactive about these kinds of things and looking to the future, whereas a lot of vets and veterinary practices and veterinary owners are very much navel-gazing, going, oh, it was so wonderful, we'll just keep doing the same thing, it worked before.
I've always done it. I agree. My husband said the same thing. He's like, are you surprised? Are you really surprised that they're not jumping on board and being proactive? And I was like, yeah, you're right. That's the whole point of Kick-Ass Vets is, come on, guys, let's progress the profession. Let's move things along. Let's get up to speed and get where we need to be. And I think that a lot with the new generation, you know, the pros or cons against millennials, a lot of millennials and the new generation isn't tolerating that backwards thought anymore and isn't afraid to stand up and say, no, this isn't okay. I'm not going to tolerate that. I'm not going to work in standards and conditions and perform medicine that's out of date just because you said so. So I'm really hoping that with this new generation that's like, fight authority, we're going to get progression, but it's definitely a slow wave. And I know, you know, the salaries are a huge problem because most vets, especially coming out of the debt loads that you're seeing out of the States and the full fee paying positions in Australia, you can't afford it. You cannot afford to be a vet. You need to work a job and a half, two jobs, three jobs. Like, it's ridiculous. So it is quite a crazy world out there.
Yes, totally.
All right, I'm going to bug you about some questions. So first of all, you have obviously started this website. I'm going to pull up this website a bit. Do you want to just tell us about that and why you started and what your passion is and what kind of message you want to get out to the vet community with your website?
Yeah, so I started this last year when I was in this position where I could see all the problems of the world in front of me and not really finding any help or guidance through that. And the veterinary profession at the moment, I mean, up until even before the COVID thing, is that it's very pessimistic. Everybody's saying, oh, this is awful. Everything's going wrong. What do we do? But nobody's actually been talking about the problems and what they actually are and trying to find out the underlying reason for them. Which is why I call my blog Chewing the Cud, Ruminations on a Veterinary Theme, because we need to start talking about these things.
Yeah.
And when we start talking about them, we will come up with ideas of how to fix them. I'm not claiming that I've got any special ideas or anything other than just random thoughts, but the more people think about it in total, we will come up with some of these ideas. And then we need to start to be able to stand up for what we need and want as well. So that's kind of where that blog's come from as well, to be able to start people thinking about where things are going wrong in the profession and how we could start thinking about how to fix them.
Awesome. So the website, it's mainly the blogs just trying to promote conversations, promote discussions, and try to get people thinking of new ideas.
Yeah.
Perfect. That's awesome. That's, yeah, same thing with mine. Basically, you know, we just want to get people to a place where they can be happy in their career. Because I'm like you, I love being a vet. I love my job. It's so amazing. It is one of the best professions, but it's just hard because there's this what you love, and then you hit a wall whether it's, you know, feeling undervalued, feeling unsupported, you know, constantly trying to do proper medicine, and then your boss just giving the convenient injection anyways. Like, things like that just eat at your reserve, and you just get to this point where you're like, I can't do this anymore. You can only bang your head on a wall so many times before that wall breaks through and you walk out the door and into another profession. So I applaud you for doing this, and I think it's great that we're all trying to do this, and the more people that do it, I think will be better.
Totally.
You did stay for quite a long time in your job. So in the mixed practice job, you were there for 6 years. In the other clinic, you were there for 10 years. Do you think that you stayed there because they were truly very good jobs with opportunities, or was it more there weren't other options, or was it just the dogma of the time? Now, you know, it's the gig economy. To stay in a job for 10 years is pretty unusual, and no one even really expects it these days. Kind of, why do you think you felt you were in those jobs for so long?
They were actually good jobs. So the mixed practice job, really supportive team. It felt like, everyone was working together with that. Although mentoring and support was not really a thing at that time when you were a new graduate, this is 18 years ago, I did have mentoring and support. And one of my bosses at that time, Andrea, she is still a really good friend. It was a community, and we felt part of the community as well. We were going out to do a service rather than just servicing people. Mm-hmm. So it felt really good. But it was, as I said before, fire brigade work. And I thought, I can't do this forever. I'm not using the stretching my brain. I'm not growing or anything. I was still doing the same job at 6 years out as I was as a new graduate.
So just lack of really professional growth.
I hadn't progressed. So I made that decision that I loved the life and I loved the practice, but I couldn't do that forever. So that's why I left that one. The small animal job, again, that started off as a small knit, well-knit team. We worked really well together. As the practice was growing, I was growing as well. I did lots of ultrasonography, and then that led on to my interest in medicine. And then I did a certificate in medicine. And yes, I was growing. And but then as the practice grew, the support kind of fell away from that as well. And the practice evolved as well, is that you could see they had, that they told us they had management consultants come in to tell them how they could do things better. And the focus of the practice changed from more from a kind of a, almost like a family, we do this together, and work things through, and making money as a sideline of that, to the absolute opposite by the end. By the time that I changed, was that their sole focus was to make as much money, and that's what we were actually told to our faces, is that it was to make as much money as possible. That's the sole reason we're there, and that just doesn't work for vets. That is not why we became vets. So being told that, so I was going about to go through this burnout, and I could say, look, I'm working far too many hours here, I need to cut down. And their response to that was, you're salaried, it doesn't say in your contract how many hours you work, so you're going to work until all the work is done. That is exactly what they told me. And I thought, I can't do this.
That's one of the big things that I always try to make sure when I do a job interview, even if you're on a salary, I make sure that it's a salary per hour, because those jobs where you're on a salary, unless, you know, some jobs it's fine. You know, one day you leave an hour early, one day you stay an hour late, and it's fine. But that's not the norm, especially new grads. I don't know about here, probably here as well, but especially in Canada, people were often working 78 hours a week. You know, when you work out your pay per hour, it was like $15 an hour. Like, you could work at McDonald's and make more than that. And it does, it just, it leads to burnout. There was no time. And so one of the things I really push to the students is, if you are on a salary, make sure it's per hour, and make sure there's stipulations for overtime, and make sure that they're going to pay you for overtime, because not because you want the overtime money necessarily, but because you want them to get you out the door on
time. To value it.
Yeah. And to, you should be paid for the hours that you work. If you work 50 hours, you should be paid. If you work 20 hours, you should be paid for 20 hours. That's just, I know, that's just me though.
But it's also to feel valued for what you're giving to the practice as well. Because I think that that's something that seems to have changed in the profession, is that that value, it's now kind of a disconnect between what you're getting paid and the value you're getting out of the work from the practices side, is that they just see numbers on a spreadsheet and how much they can do that, rather than the person. If we push them too hard, then it's not so good, so maybe we should back off a bit. That's my feeling anyway.
And it's, I am kind of the mind frame, like, I understand that the businesses have to run, they need to make money in order to pay you appropriately. And a lot of people, and especially new grads, the comment I always get all the time, with your experience, I'd like to get your input on it, is, aren't you afraid you're going to overservice? And IDEX did a study recently, and they showed that in the States, 20% of needed medical care is getting to patients. My thought is, if you honestly and openly recommend what the patient needs, you will far exceed any amount of money that you need to bring. I never recommend anything I don't think they need. And I think we as a profession in general far under recommend, because we're afraid of looking greedy and this public perception. But a lot of new grads are very afraid of that. And I think that clinics should be talking about money with vets, and they need to understand, yes, this is a business. You do need to bring in money in order to afford your salary. But in that clinic, obviously the focus was pushed on, you need to make money, versus this is what the animals need. How do you feel about that? And do you feel that they could have had the same outcome with a different approach in that conversation?
Yes, definitely. Because yes, you're quite right. practices need to make money. They are businesses, and if they don't make profit, they are not going to be there. That's the basis of it. But it's often how management put these things to us as the employees. Mm-hmm. And that just shows the complete lack of leadership in a lot of places, I think, is that we still need to make money, but it's the reasons to getting there that are missing. So management come in and say, you just need to make money. Whereas a leader would probably be going, well, as you say, we recommend the best treatments and we explain to clients, we educate them why getting their dog's teeth seen to is important. You can't just not breathe around the dog because it smells. And the money will come, rather than it just mm-hmm. being about the money, because we don't become vets just to make money. If mm-hmm. if we did, then we're in the wrong profession.
We're all very stupid.
Yeah. So, and I think also the other side of that is it comes from a mindset position of vets. So we feel awkward talking about money. We don't want to tell Mrs. Bloggs, who's 80 and has come in with her little Yorkshire Terrier with its awful mouth, that the dental's going to cost £500, $1,000 Australian to fix its mouth. It's like, oh, Mrs. Bloggs, it's going to cost a lot of money. It's like, we do ourselves no favour by having these mindsets and our biases that mean that when we do know we should be doing something, we're putting it in such a way that the client is going to go, you've got some kind of undertone in what you're telling me there. I'm not quite sure that I want to go with that.
Yeah, I agree. It's the way that we present it. Oh, it's going to cost a lot of money. No, we're going to help your dog's teeth so that he doesn't get heart disease, so you can love him longer. This is how much it costs. And it's, I think we need to take away that whole concept of what we feel something is worth, because we don't value ourselves enough to appreciate our own time. So therefore we don't think that we don't think that we're smart enough to charge $100 for a consult. You know, you have to really think, I worked really hard. I'm smart. I have information. Talking to me for 20 minutes is worth $100. You need to feel that as a vet. And I think that really, people need to embrace that and understand that their expertise, their time, their student debt, their years of education are incredibly valuable, and not go and be like, oh, I think, you know, it's going to be 500. Because I have that problem all the time. I work with people and they say, oh, you know, it's expensive. The foreign body surgery is going to be $4,000. It's like, no, you don't start with it's expensive. When you go to the mechanic, they're not like, oh, it's going to be expensive, but you need new tires or you're going to get in a car accident and die. They say, your tires are bald. This is dangerous. Let me order you new tires. They cost this much. And they don't pre-put in a value of, they don't like preconceive this idea to you of what it's worth, where we do that so often in vet med, I find. Do you find that as well?
Totally. And I used to fall into that trap as well.
I did too.
I had absolutely zero communication training at university, because remember, I graduated like in the dark ages. There was zero communication training. So for the first 10, 15, 12 years of my career, my communication was what I'd learned from my mentors and when I'd been seeing practice as a student and things. And it probably got by, especially with farmers. It's all right. I'd just be blunt. But dealing with small animal clients is very different. So I started to become interested in communication and how to be able to, get things set up in the consulting room so that you're in control, rather than bowing down always to what the client is wanting to do in that situation.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any kind of top tips for new grads going out, things that you kind of learned and did for yourself that helped you in those communication aspects?
Oh, dear.
I know, hard question.
Oh, I think we could probably spend a few hours just on that, unfortunately.
Yeah,
I know. I think it's having the confidence to go forward with what you know is right. You've been through 5 years of vet school. Most of what you're seeing is stuff that you know that you're either going to need to treat. So you see manky mouth, you know it needs treatment. You're going to need to do some investigations. And that's not because you don't know what's wrong. That's because nobody knows what's wrong. or you're going to probably might make the occasional recommendation for quality of life and euthanasia. You have three options. So be confident. Say, the best thing for your dog at this moment in time is we get its teeth soon too. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not ego. You don't want to go in all blustery and it's like, I'm king of the world, I'm a vet. But I think a lot of new graduates are a bit, I recommend a dental.
Yeah.
But it is, actually, that's a good analogy. It's an act. When you put your consulting top on, you become an actor. Mm-hmm. And that actor is, you need to be the confident vet that Mrs. Bloggs wants to see, and she knows that you're going to give the best treatment. It doesn't matter if inside you're feeling wrong, you need to act that to be able to get the best out of the situation. And I think eventually it becomes not an act, it becomes who you are. You then do become confident in your recommendations.
Yeah.
And doing further CPD training, my certificate, I become more confident in what I'm saying. But that doesn't mean to say I don't get situations where I haven't the foggiest what's going on. They still happen on a regular basis.
For sure. But it wouldn't be medicine. You wouldn't need a doctorate degree if those didn't happen. That's the point. You need to know what you know and what you don't know, and you need to know what test is going to give you that. But yeah, I agree 100%. Fake it till you make it, and then you have to put on that face and display that confidence. I agree. I think that's a great tip for new grads.
And I know it's really difficult for some new graduates who look like they're 12. I've just turned 40, and just a few weeks ago I had a client say, "And dear, when is the vet going to come in?" It's like, "I am the vet." She said, "Oh, I'm so sorry, I thought you were the nurse."
When I graduated, because I looked very young, I tried to wear makeup for about one day, and then halfway through the day I had smears all over my face, because of course I don't wear makeup, so I touch my face all the time. I wash my face 1,000 times a day. So that ended very quickly. So I got a white jacket embroidered with my name on it, Dr. Anne Dion. And that, I think, made a big difference, because then when you walk in the room, they automatically see you labeled. So it's that protective armor for new grads. I don't do it anymore. I don't wear that anymore, because now I'm just like, hey, I'm the vet. How can I help you? And I have that confidence. But as a new grad, to me, that was really helpful to have that outward, this is who I am. And I worked in a practice that had one old male vet for ages. So they didn't want to see a girl. They wanted to see the man vet. So it was a hard clientele to break into. So I think that's, like you're saying, it's an act. Sometimes putting on the costume, I think, helps as well.
Yes, and don't hurry in consults as well, is another thing as well, is that people seem look at the clock and go, right, I've got 10-15 minutes for the next appointment, and they just kind of rattle through the whole thing. The most important bits are actually the pauses. So give your recommendation to Mrs. Bloggs, like, Snowy's mouth is awful, we need to fix his teeth, this is how much it's going to cost, and then stop.
Yeah, just, I say that in negotiations too. This is what I'm worth, this is why I'm awesome, this is what I'm worth, this is a salary that I think that's appropriate, and then shut up. Just count to 10 in your head, because I think when you're not confident, what you end up doing in that silence, you feel uncomfortable with it, and then you start to negotiate yourself down. Oh, but I'll take, if that's not available, like, just be quiet and let them talk. And I think you're right. I've never thought about that in terms of in a consult as well, but you're right. Just being quiet is very helpful, because then you're making them take the next step independent of your bias, essentially.
Yeah, I hadn't seen it in that light either. So a consult really is a negotiation, really.
Yeah, it's educating and then trying to convince them to part with their resources for what you want for their pet. And it's how much you can convince them that what you're saying is worth it to them. And it's really messed up that we get into this for the science, and we get into this for the medicine, and we get into this for the pets. And so much of our job is selling. Everything's selling, and it's
communication. Yeah.
Yes, for sure. So you're obviously locuming now. Are you enjoying the concept of locuming and the aspect independent of the whole COVID cutting your shifts and the job security? Would you recommend locuming to people? Would you not? How do you feel about it? And what would make you go back to full time, essentially?
Okay, so locuming for me is just a short-term gap, because with the recruitment crisis, I'm struggling to find the right job out of all the jobs that are out there. I thought, well, let me buy myself some time to look for the right job and go locuming. And secondly, also to work as a locum in the practices that I might want to accept a full-time job there.
Yes.
I know that locuming is not going to suit me long-term.
Why not?
I like stability.
Okay.
I like stability. And, well, the COVID just put all that out the window. I want to be able to build a team. I also, because I have interest in leadership and improving things, improving standards, evidence-based medicine, all those other things, as a locum, I don't get to do any of that. So I want to go into a position in a practice where I can affect some kind of positive changes.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, locuming is just a short-term gap until I find the best fit job.
Mm-hmm.
As to other people, I think that certainly this day and age, with this such a big gig economy, people don't want to stay in the same place for very long, in which case locuming might well suit them really, really well. They're free to go traveling for blocks or take time off to do study or anything like that. So, yeah, I think it really fits with the younger generations.
Mm-hmm.
And that's shown in the figures in the UK. The RCVS, so our regulator, released their survey that they did last year on various different things of the profession. One of the questions in there is, what do people work as? And one in four vets who are in employee situations, mm-hmm. so in other words, not owners or partners or anything like that, one in four employee situation vets are working independently.
Oh,
so
wow.
Locums,
yeah.
Or traveling specialists or consultants.
That's
so
a big chunk.
It's a big proportion of the profession, and I can't see that getting smaller. I can only see that getting bigger.
Yeah.
As people try to take back control of situations in their working lives that they can't control any other way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's why I did it. I was full-time and I always locumed on the side, but I always had a full-time gig because I get very stressed out when I don't have job stability and money coming in and knowing where it's going to come from. And even in this economy where literally every single day I get asked to work, every day. And I didn't even put myself out on any of those sites. I can't even imagine putting yourself out there on LinkedIn and Facebook. Like, I get inundated with work without even doing that. So that must have been incredibly overwhelming, I can imagine. But it's one of those crazy things where, you know, I was working in a full-time job. I said, this is what I need. This is why I'm unhappy. This is the salary that is appropriate, and I'll take the low end of that, but I'm not going to go less than that. And I needed a set schedule was really the biggest thing there. And they were just like, no. I was like, okay, see ya. And I think they thought I was bluffing, because I went in what I thought was my exit interview, and they're like, oh, so what can we do to get you to stay? I was like, what is happening? Like, I literally have been telling you for 8 months repeatedly in multiple emails, multiple documents, multiple template schedules that I would work, exactly what I would do. And I've already lined up another job, and I already told the manager that, like, she knows. She knows I'm leaving. And the head boss just had no idea. Like, just the communication was obscene. And then I went to full locuming, but I'm actually now going on as a permanent part-time because the employer that I'm working for right now is so amazing. And they...
Hey.
I know. And it's... You know,
there are good ones out there.
There are. And it's in this crisis, they are the one clinic that actually has no lack for vets. They constantly have vets looking to work for them. And, you know, a lot of clinics are saying, oh, there's just a crisis and there's nothing we can do about it. But that's not true. There are clinics there that have constant influxes of people wanting to work there because word of mouth is so important in the vet community that people are like, yeah, that clinic's great to work for. So then other vets are like, oh, maybe I can get a job there. And honestly, my job description isn't going to change at all. My wage really isn't going to change at all going to permanent part-time with them. And I'm doing it out of loyalty because they have been incredibly supportive of me as a casual at that clinic. And I think it's a lot of businesses just say, oh, it's not our fault, there's nothing we can do. But I think the reality is there is something they can do. And you're looking for a full-time position of, you know, obviously incredibly experienced, amazing vet looking for a clinic and can't find a clinic that's kind of going to meet your needs. That's ridiculous. Like, that's crazy that there's not a clinic out there that would be like, okay, what do you need? Let's get you on board.
Well, the other side of that is the stretching of the truth that happens because clinics are so desperate. And that's what happened in my last two jobs. Yeah. And why I'm being extra cautious is that because experienced vets are really quite few and far between, someone who wants to settle down like me is really rare, is that I've been to interviews and, yeah, I don't know if they're telling the truth or not. Are you really going to be giving that? Because I've had two stings over the past couple of years. Yeah. Is that, do I want to take that risk as well?
What's the? Can you share with us what the biggest sting, the promise that wasn't fulfilled, or is that, or do you not want to breach that in terms of, I know the vet world is very small, so sometimes you don't want to talk about things. I guess.
I'll do it very generally. So one of them was that it was a hospital it was a practice that aspired to be a hospital status, but they needed someone to give it that final push to get standards up and to get the changes in place, and also to do lots of internal medicine, internal referrals and
that sounds perfect for you.
Perfect. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, guess what, when I get there? No, they don't want to change.
Yeah, it's so frustrating. And I've talked to some vets that haven't had that experience of going into a clinic and the boss just refusing to do anything that is updated. And they're like, that doesn't exist. I'm like, oh, it exists. You know, you still have people giving steroids to every head trauma that walks through, even though they're in shock. And you're like, just stop. Give them pain relief. Just give them pain relief. But yeah, it's crazy.
And then they don't get the pain relief because they remember something from like 50 years ago that says it increases intracranial pressure.
Right. Yes, I know. I know. And don't give fluids in a hemangiosarcoma because they don't want to drop the PCB. That's one of my favorites. I'm like, no, your anal's in shock and dying. It needs to circulate the few little red blood cells it has left. Get them around. Yeah, I know. I've been in those situations too. And one of my biggest recommendations is always do a working interview of a minimum 1 week, but ideally longer, because yeah, anyone can fake it Monday, Tuesday, but by Friday, you usually start to see people's true colors and see kind of what they're like.
Yeah. And that's really difficult to do if you are still in another job as an employee, yeah, which is why the locum in comes in.
Yes. Yeah. As new grads, I really try to push them to do rotations at places where they're thinking of working because it's the best way to get that experience. But yeah, I did a working interview as a new grad at a clinic and they were like, yeah, we want to update our medicine and blah, blah, blah. We have such a good team. We all go running together, you know, go swimming. Like, it was great. I was like, this is amazing. And then they did a C-section that they were just going to mask down, and a planned C-section in a Sharpay that they were going to mask down, not put in an IV. And I was, you know, the student being like, oh, I'm just curious. I wonder why you're doing that way. In school, we're taught that, you know, propofol or Alfax is actually better than because you don't want to step on their toes, right? The boss literally took a bottle of propofol and threw it at me and was like, fine, you do the anesthetic. And this was on Wednesday. Tuesday, I was talking to my now husband, saying, I think I'm going to take this job. I think it's good. And then like by Wednesday, everything kind of shifted. All the masks came off, and then they couldn't get an IV in the dog to give it propofol, and then said, F it, and masked it anyways. I was like, okay, so when it crashes and you can't get an IV in the awake and it wasn't like it was fighting. They just couldn't get an IV. I was like, you realize when it's under anesthetic, it's going to be way harder
even harder
to get an IV. I was just like, yeah. I can't. But yeah, that's the kind of stuff that you see when you do the working interview. I think locuming's great for that. It's definitely a good way to do it. But okay, what else do I want to bug you about? What are you looking for in a clinic? I guess that's the big question in terms of what would make you sign on full time at a clinic.
Whoa, I've got a very, very long list of requirements. My husband says that it might be unrealistic to expect a clinic can fulfill all of those. But I'm an optimist, so I'm just hoping that there's somewhere out there that can at least fill most of them. Mm-hmm. And I've prioritised them as well. It's not like all of them are a complete no-no or anything like that. So I'm at the stage of my career that I want to be able to balance my clinical work, but also have some input into non-clinical side. So be able to help the practice get better if it's not already a great one, keep it there if it is there, and have my voice heard as part of the discussion. My long-term dream was always to buy into partnership in a veterinary practice.
That was going to be my next question. It sounds like you want to be an owner. Why not?
Well, not an owner, a partner, because I don't know if this was if this has happened as your same kind of thing in Australia, but up until 15 years ago, veterinary practices were owned by vets, and they were owned by a group of vets who were partners in the business. So you'd have some senior partners that had been there longer and getting towards retirement, and then you'd have junior partners coming in, learning from the senior partners how to run the practice, whatever their form of leadership was, and then they would become the senior partners. And there'd be the cycle through that you'd learn from other people as you became a partner. And as you were one of several vets in control of the practice, there may only be a few associates underneath them, is that you shared the workload as well.
Yeah.
So corporates coming in has completely changed that. So now there are really, I don't think there are really any partnerships out there to be bought, because when practices come up for sale, their associates can't afford to buy them. So they're sold to corporates. And then the corporate model is very different. They have tends to be one person in charge of the practice, usually called something like a clinic director. But they are really, the function is they are like the sole owner of that practice. So they are there on their own dealing with all of the problems of that practice themselves, with supposedly some support from head office and things, but that's a little bit vague as to how much support you actually get with that. So that's a very different proposition.
Yeah. So you just don't want to have that all on your shoulders at once.
No. I've been reading a lot about leadership and management and things, but I haven't actually been able to do much of it. So I don't know if I'm actually any good myself. Yeah. And to go straight into being a clinic director and a completely unknown team, they don't know me, and then having to set that up from scratch, I think that's a dangerous proposition for both sides there. And I can see that's why some clinics are really struggling there as well.
Yeah.
And then there's ownership. It's even before this COVID thing, it was a very difficult proposition in the UK to set up your own practice, to be able to get enough funds. So even if you're not buying a building, you're leasing it, you need to have a minimum of about £150,000. So that's about $300,000 US, Australian dollars. To set it up. And then because you would be the only vet, be working 70, 80 hour weeks and have all the stress of the business and immediately having to be an employer.
Yeah.
And there's so much red tape in that in the UK as well. So it's, these are all things I've been thinking about over the past year, and there is no one right way at the moment. Yeah. And with this COVID thing, it could all change very, very quickly as well. I think there's certainly lots of areas in the UK that have got too many small veterinary practices, and each one's only just surviving. So this may well mean that there is unfortunately clinics that close and don't reopen after this. And maybe some of the corporates are going to amalgamate some of their practices, so you end up with bigger practices in one centre. Lots of change coming. The best thing to do is be optimistic.
It's one of those things where I think it's in Australia, it's a lot of corporates, and you're having that. In Canada, it's still mainly independent owned. Corporates are just starting to go in there, but it's kind of well behind that curve. They kind of kept out corporate until, I would say, close to when I was graduating, I think, is when the first corporate started to come in, and that was 6 years ago. So most clinics are still independently owned, but lots are one owner and then associates. There are some that are the partner situation that you described, but I guess, you know, if I went home and opened a clinic, I would expect to be the only owner and hire associates. And basically, you're right, it is dangerous. And that's why a lot of the current climate is, you know, we're not taught management, we're not taught how to run a business. So a lot of vet clinics are terribly managed and are terrible businesses. And you really have to have a desire to run a business. And if you don't have that desire to run a business, then the thought of opening a clinic is really daunting. So it's one of those things where I think I struggle with the same thing. If, you know, when I go home, do I want to run a clinic or do I just want to be an associate? Because I don't want to, you have to be tied to it. You have to be married to that job and you don't have any backup. I think what you talked about the partnership sounds wonderful. I wish there were more like that. That I think a lot more people would buy in. And if those existed, maybe that's something that, you know, groups of people should try to be getting into and sharing the load, and then having that junior vet, if we can try to push the profession back into that, that sounds like a great solution to some of the problems. It's just finding a group of vets that works well enough together to go into business. It's like you have to work better to them than your marriage sometimes, because it's more stressful because you don't have those other, you know, forgivenesses that you would have. So it's kind of a crazy situation. We'll see where it ends up. But yeah, I wouldn't want to buy in that circumstance either. That sounds very scary.
No. And the banks aren't wanting to loan any money where they weren't before, and they're probably even less likely to now. So yeah. I can't find that amount of money. So,
yeah, crazy. Yeah.
And the clinical side of my work is still probably more important to me than the non-clinical side.
Yeah.
Although at the moment, because I'm locuming, my clinical side I have less control over. Like, I'm not doing high-end abdominal ultrasounds. I'm not doing any cardiology. Therefore, I am doing more of the non-clinical work because that keeps my interest going as well.
Can you not do those types of things, that expertise with the ultrasound, in the clinics where you're locuming? Can't you let them know, hey, I can do these things, you can line them up, I can come in and create your own little kind of side business where you come in and contract yourself out?
Yes, I have suggested that to some clinics. Problem is, most of the clinics I work in have ancient or very, very low quality ultrasound machine. So I'm talking like an ultrasound machine that is pre-existing when I became a vet. I looked on the back and the plate said 1997 was when it was.
Nice.
So yes, I don't want to compromise the service that I'm offering by saying, oh yeah, I can do a high-end ultrasound scan, and then they give me this 3-year-old machine and I go,
well,
no, I can't.
You know the solution, buy an ultrasound. Bring your own ultrasound. Yeah. They're becoming more and more affordable. And one of the things in one of my blogs that I wrote about is, you know, if you're really good at ultrasound, that's something you can do within a couple of years or sooner, depending on how much you promote yourself. You can make that back really quickly because the ultrasounds are becoming so much more affordable. You should just do that.
Yeah. That is a thought, exactly. But I have also found that most of the practices around this area just want a vet.
Yeah.
They want somebody who has experience and can be left on their own and can get on with the ops and stuff. But they don't want someone as experienced as I am. So I've actually taken a pay cut to become a locum because the premium that I would get as an employee, because I can do high-end medicine and ultrasonography, cardiology, etc., I can't charge that as a locum because these practices around here are just looking for that person who's a few steps below me. So if I want to work, I have to just charge the normal rate.
Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah, because most places the locuming is much more economical than working full time, just based on the rates you can get, and mainly because associates are being underpaid. You know, when you work at a clinic that is paying where I'm going on permanent part time, their locum rate and their paid rate are the same when you work out the math and the benefits. And that's just, there was no negotiation with them. They were like, this is my rate. I was like, that's great. I'm fine with that rate. And they're like, this is just what we pay. And this is what we pay otherwise. And they just pay appropriately. But most places I would be getting double per hour what I would get if I were an employee, which is crazy. So it's crazy that you're taking a pay cut. That must be frustrating because you're not getting the benefit to weigh out the cons of the lack of stability and not having the control in the clinics. So
No, but it was also my choice as well.
Yeah. So, well, you got to try stuff, right?
That's a big thing.
You gotta try and you gotta go around and find your place. So
and it's definitely eye-opening being a locum, going into practices that you wouldn't normally work in. You would never accept a full-time employee position there. Going in and go, oh my goodness, I'm so glad that I have a choice not to work here permanently.
It's shocking how bad some clinics can be. Yes, that's definitely a thing. So just, I guess, to wrap up so that I don't keep you forever, do you feel that there are any... You know, if you could impart any information or, you know, get the new grads or the young grads or vets of any level of experience to do two things with their profession or with their life, what are the two big things that you really want people to do?
Okay. First thing is know what makes you tick. So I found this really, really hard to do. I did this a couple of years ago. So finding out what your values are and what is your underlying reason for doing anything in your life? What gets you out of bed? And it's really hard and painful to do that. I didn't, but I have heard that coaching can help really well with that as well, to draw out what these fine threads of your underlying psyche are. So once you know what makes you tick, you can then choose to do things that fit with your underlying values. And if those are in balance, then that will keep both sides happy, I'd say.
Yeah.
Number one. Number two, know what your boundaries are. So... as vets, we are awful. I'll just keep doing this extra bit of overtime. I'll get home when the case is finished, and then 2 hours later you're going...
Yeah, because the next five cases have come in that you've... Okay, just one more. Okay. Yeah, I had to learn that one.
Know your boundaries and stick to them, because you're in a career that's going to be lasting 40 plus years. If you burn out early, then it is a struggle to get back on your feet. So, yeah. Know what your boundaries are, set them, make sure people know, and don't feel guilty for setting them either. Yeah, you've got to protect yourself before you can help other people.
Yeah, awesome. I think those are two phenomenal tips, where if people did that...
Can I add another one? Can I be
first? Of course you can, yes, of course.
Do something that's not vetty as well.
Yes.
So many vets just do vets. And then get home and then going on the social media forums and talk about more vet stuff and do more vets and go to conferences and more vets. Make sure you do something in your life that is not being a vet.
What is your...
Something that's not. So whether that's exercise. For me, it's crafting.
Nice. What do you craft?
Making things.
Yeah. Anything in particular, with wood or clay or...
Everything. Everything. I collect crafting, is what my husband says. My office upstairs has got a computer in the corner, and the rest are cupboards of crafting stuff. So I've
done
silver jewelry making. I am currently doing hand embroidery, needle felting, anything I can make with my hands. And I think that's probably a good fit for being a vet as well. I'm using my hands, but it's also nothing to do with being a vet as well.
Mm-hmm. that's amazing. That's, yeah, that's awesome.
What do you do?
I try to exercise, but I'm always getting back into it. You know, it's the first run every time. And we travel, but that's intermittently. But my husband would definitely say, he does say all the time, I need a hobby. So I am currently on the hunt for something that is not vetty, because I think you're right. That is incredibly important to have something that isn't vet. And I struggle with that a lot. I'm, you know, your typical type A workaholic North American, and it's really unhealthy. So that's a struggle that I'm fighting with. So I got a guitar. We sent our guitar over and I haven't touched it in months. So maybe I'll go do that tonight. You've inspired me to push more on that.
Good plan.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for being part of the solution and trying to progress the profession and getting to people where they want to be and need to be in this profession so that they can be happy, which is what we all want, and improve mental health and all of that. Get those scary stats that are involved in the vet community down. And I really hope that you find the job that you're looking for. I think a clinic would be super lucky to have you, and just keep looking. It's I didn't expect to find a clinic that was going to be supportive, and I didn't expect to ever come back after locuming. And I talked to my boss and was like, oh, we really want you to come on permanent part time. And I was like, oh, yeah, you know what? You guys deserve it. You have been awesome. You've been supportive. You do CE. It's a great environment. You care about people's schedules and mental health, and they do everything right. And those clinics do exist. So hopefully you find one very soon.
I hope so too. And it's been great speaking to you today, Anne. And maybe we can catch up about travel at some point.
Yes, for sure. All right. Thank you so much.